Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Well, hello, and welcome to Chef's Story. I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today our chef is John Besh from Louisiana. We're taping, actually, today at the International Culinary Center. And John, I'm just so excited that you're here. If you don't know John, you have to go down to New Orleans, because he has the restaurants that people lust after. Probably the most famous is August, but he also has Besh Steak, Luc San Antonio, La Provence, American Sector, Soda Shop, Dominica, and Borgna. Borgna, is that the
Born.
Name? Born. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it's
a Louisiana spell,
and it's right. You extend outside of New Orleans too, right? But John also is, of course, he was one of Food & Wine's top 10 best new chefs in America. He's won the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Southeast in 2006. 2009, he got the Silver Spoon Award from Food Arts. His restaurant August is in the Gallo Top 40 Restaurants, the Wine Enthusiast Top 100 Restaurants. You know, he's one of those guys who just... he wins it all, and he defines New Orleans and the South, and we're just going to delve right into it. So you are from Louisiana, are you not?
I am from Louisiana.
Okay. Well, so, and did you grow up? Born and raised in New Orleans?
I grew up in the country outside of New Orleans, just right down the, literally right down the road from where it is, not street, but road, from where it is that I live now. And so I live on the same bayou that I grew up on, and it really and I never thinking I would return home. Of course, every kid I think leaves their hometown thinking that you're just done with it, but that wasn't really the case. You know, I left, and each time I left, the city kept calling me back. And
So you grew up on the bayou.
Grew up out in the country.
Out in the country.
Hunting, fishing, cooking.
Tell me, were you eating at 5 years old?
The same thing that I eat now, really. And that's the beauty of having this indigenous cuisine of the New Orleans area. And outside of, like, eyes shut from New Orleans, the cuisine changes drastically. And so it's growing up eating and cooking with the seasons was just normal. Shrimp season, you ate a lot of shrimp. You only eat crawfish within crawfish
season.
There
is a season for shrimp?
Oh, yeah. So shrimp season begins in May, and then basically carries through the fall. And then it'll close down once quota's reached and reopen again in May. And crawfish, same thing. The crawfish really come into season around New Year's, and then by July the crawfish are finished. And so you growing up eating with the season and eating what the earth actually provides you, cooking in a style that has historical significance, I think just kind of it formed me into what I've become today. And not just a preservationist, but I think it gave me the foundation that I'd need to pursue being a chef later in life. And I think we always hear about these, you know, we were talking about Chef Soltner and Sayek and Jacques Pepin and all these great chefs that came from France, or for that matter, the great ones that came from Italy or Spain, all came from incredibly rich food backgrounds. You know, whether it's peasant food or not, there was a historical significance and there was a story behind their food. And I think the same goes for some of us, you know, in and around New Orleans, where we grew up with a really identifiable food.
Right. So New Orleans as the city, it's got four or five cultures, very strong cultures there. But you grew up outside the city. Explain to a New Yorker, what's the difference, with Cajun, is it Creole,
right.
Louisiana?
So you have,
tell me, and where do you fit in that mix?
Well, that's a very good question, because you do have this whole Cajun thing, and you have the Creole thing, and where the two really split, or the Cajun would be the country cousin to Creole. Cajun is the one-pot cooking from southwest Louisiana, or west to southwest Louisiana, where just outside of New Orleans, you head to the west, and you're in rice country. You're in, this is where sugar cane and rice kind of come from. And that style of cooking has it was very much a peasant-based style of food, where it was the Acadians that actually were kicked out of Nova Scotia. We all know the history of that. They come to Louisiana. They take these old French traditions, including their language, which really had been kept in this time capsule for 200 years, and brought it to a very remote part of Louisiana where they settled and started cooking what was indigenous to that area. And so they adapted their old French recipes. The etouffees would then become crawfish etouffees because you had the crawfish and the rice and so on and so forth. Well, Creole is a whole different animal. Creole, as we call New Orleans Creole, it's really this beautiful mixture. Almost, you could say it's a cultural gumbo, so to speak, of French and Spanish and African and German and Italian, all thrown into this pot. And because New Orleans is a port city and a very important port to the states, and even to before it became part of the Union, strategically speaking, very important, being at the mouth of the Mississippi River, where it empties into the Gulf of Mexico. And so you always had a very cosmopolitan feel in any port city, but New Orleans in particular. And so you had New Orleans had the only sizable population that you could in that area.
Was there when ever it was a being traded cultural group with a French ever
French owned it, and then it was ceded to Spain. Then Spanish really didn't have the means of populating it. They conscripted all these Canary Islanders to. They had no choice. They would pack these people up and ship them off to Louisiana, and so there various
the Acadians come
and then the Acadians come in, but they really stayed out of New Orleans. And New Orleans is really populated with French, with some French, and then you had the Canary Islanders. You had the indigenous people that the Native Americans that had been there prior, and then you have you have all these Africans coming, both free and enslaved peoples coming, and so it was really, you had so many things happening, but
they were all learning to live together,
and they still had not the population to really to populate New Orleans. Mm. In a sustainable manner. So they go out and they sell these land bonds to all these Germans. They bring Alsatians and
Andre Soltner could have
a lot of people from Alsace, and at that part of time it would have been a more German leaning, and then you had a lot of people from Baden-Württemberg that were brought over. And so whole villages, Catholic and Jewish alike, make their way on these ships to New Orleans, and it was a real struggle. But the interesting thing is that what you had in New Orleans, you had this idea that you had to assimilate into this Franco-Creole culture that existed there, because the French founded it, and even though the Spanish might have owned it for a period of time, it was still dominated by French culture, and so everything was given a French name. And so when people immigrated there, as opposed to Ellis Island, you come there, and then your name, francified, where you then the Volts became Fults, and and Beches would lose SCHs and just become SH or CH, as in the French.
I was
Beche.
Wondering how your
and
name
so you
played.
Had
yeah.
all these different cultures that kind of that came together to assimilate into this Creole culture that existed there, and really, I think you could the Americans really hadn't a huge impact on New Orleans until after the Civil War, when you had a lot of
really. So it was very international with those.
Absolutely,
because it had always been 1803, I think.
Right, and so you always had, but it had been just geographically and politically speaking on its own little island, and so far removed from the rest of. The American population. And I think there was a sense of lawlessness. I think that still exists. This idea still exists today. Which it's a very intriguing place to come from, because there is there's a story about everything, and what I find more intriguing is that we've actually kept these traditions alive. They've somehow survived when so much of our indigenous, urban cultures in America have just really been eroded by this idea of Americanism, and which nothing's wrong with, but I, for the sake of preservation, I'm glad that we had been considerably isolated New Orleans.
New Orleans is New Orleans. You don't think of it as a southern city like Charleston Atlanta. It's New Orleans. It's like New York. You don't think of it as a northern city.
New York. It's in a category of its own. It has a grittiness of a New York or a Chicago, but it's still a small city.
So you are growing up in this world. You don't know anything different.
Right.
All right. So when did the world expose itself to you? And but I'm still like, where are your first food memories? How did they
my food memories were born very early from and they really were born out of hunting and fishing, in that we went to fish, then we would bring the fish home, mom would cook the fish. There was no black and red fish then.
Fish?
It was you catch a red fish, then you would want to keep a red fish that was only was large enough to fit into mom's big pot, that would then become a whole roasted or a whole braised redfish that we call redfish couvillon. But I had no idea at the time. I thought it meant it was named after the couvillons that lived next door to us. So I thought that we were just eating like their recipe. But you catch a redfish, you had redfish couvillon, or so I thought. It was actually corbillon en français. And then I'd catch a speckled trout, then the speckled trout would become trout meunière. If mom had some almonds on hand, it would be trout almondine. And so it was that simple. This is how, if you caught this fish, this is how it was cooked.
Pretty good peasant food.
Heck yeah, no, and I'm not.
Trout meunière.
And I'm not complaining, but this was just what we knew, and this is how I grew up. And, so you live by, we certainly didn't grow up having to hunt and fish for our food. We weren't, hunters and gatherers. We had grocery stores, but, this was part of that culture. And I think it gave me, from a very early age, I developed maybe an abnormal understanding of where food comes from and this connection to it. And so I think it was that, gave me, it was through the hunting and fishing that I developed a respect.
What was the weirdest thing you would eat?
Oh, I wouldn't consider anything weird, but, we would hunt rabbits and squirrels, and you would cook them. Mm-hmm. Just, you cook a squirrel the same way that you cook a rabbit. Mm-hmm. And it would normally be in a sauce piquant or in some sort of a stew or a dough.
What does a squirrel taste like?
Yeah, it's like a sweet-tasting rabbit. It's really not much different than a real rabbit, which isn't like the white meat rabbit that we might buy in Chinatown just down the street, but has a little more flavor when they're wild. And so that kind of, there was a foundation there. Another significant thing that happened when I was little, my father was hit by a drunk driver while bicycling one day and paralyzed for life. And throughout this convalescence that ensued for, heck, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, he was in and out of rehabilitation at various hospitals. I'd cook for him, and I'd cook whatever I would concoct, and it would make him happy. And I learned, so 9 years old, I made the connection of food meaning, that was, food made people happy. And I had a gift at making people happy through food. And I also had an attachment to going out and finding and, you know, and bringing the food in from the wild, cooking it, it's made me happy, made other people happy. I'm in love with this. And so I knew probably it took me meeting Paul Prudhomme when I was at his first book signing. Maybe I was 11 years old and had this, you know, bigger than life, literally, this man just signed the cookbook to me and take a few minutes just to talk to me. And I knew at that point, like, I want to be a chef.
Do you remember the conversation?
Oh, yeah. No, I remember the bookstore and the whole nine yards. And I told him that I, too, loved to cook. And he asked me what I'd like to cook. And he started talking, you know, and he had maybe it was also the first adult conversation that somebody would actually have with me, where here I am talking to this world-famous chef, and I think he had been on the cover of Time magazine that year. Like, this was big stuff.
Yeah.
And then to have him take the time to say, well, what do you like to cook? And I tell him, you know, about hunting, you know, like, I love to hunt rabbits, and then this is what we do with them. And he just thought that was great, and this is what he grew up on. Mm-hmm. And so having him take the time, probably no more than, you know, 3 to 5 minutes to chat with me, made a huge impression. And that was something that really stuck with me for a while.
All right, well, we're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about where you went with it. So
Excellent.
We'll be right back.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today's guest is John Besh from New Orleans. Most famous restaurant probably is August, and there's 9 others, I think, or 9 in total. And in how many states are you in Texas?
We have one in Texas.
Yeah. All right. So we just finished talking about John meeting Paul Prudhomme at 11, getting inspired and already cooking. So how did you start your professional journey?
I grew up, again, working in restaurants and bussing tables.
In New Orleans
Actually in Slidell, out maybe 30 minutes from downtown New Orleans, to the east, northeast. And having, you know, just kind of bitten, I was bitten by the restaurant bug early, and that I enjoyed doing that. I enjoyed bussing tables. I enjoyed coming in early and prepping in the kitchen before having to put on my clip-on bow tie and head out into the dining room. And that, I thought, just, you know, that was pleasurable. I really enjoyed the interaction with people and the idea of food bringing people together. And again, everybody's happy. So I say that because these things really just would just pop out at me, like, you know what, this is fun. This isn't work. You know, I get paid for this, and I get to eat all I want. So I grew up just passionate about that and cooking. And I also was blessed to have parents that, like, we had to work. It wasn't. It's really so different than the way that I'm raising my own children. I might need to rethink this, but I grew up with a work ethic, and that has served me very well in this career in particular. Well, okay, I knew in high school that I wanted to go to culinary school, but hey, nobody was doing that when I was in high school. This was not a common thing. Even as popular as chefs were in New Orleans, most of them were European, and you know, or lived extensively in Europe before coming back home. And so I thought, well, you know, before I do that, before I venture off to culinary school or to move to Europe to learn my craft, so to speak, I'll just join the Marine Corps. And so I did that on a whim and had so many terrible meals.
You joined Marines on a whim.
And had so many terrible meals that I just knew I had to one day get back. And I think that when I finally got back to cooking, my time in the Marines, just as a, you know, in the infantry as a forward observer and having experiences in battle and war, gave me, I think, a vision and gave me, I think, the drive that I needed to really kickstart my career in the way that it did.
Let's explore the military a little bit, because I know here at the school, the students we get from the military are among the best performing. You know, and you have the brigade system, you know, for
sure, absolutely,
for a general. Do you think, because there's so many of our military coming back
today, we chefs really love structure, period.
Yeah.
And you have to. The structure of a kitchen is no different than the structure of a military brigade, for that matter.
Yeah.
And the style of management is really no different. And yeah, I see a lot of, I work with a lot of wounded warriors, for that matter, and several of which have been very interested in the culinary arts, and we work with them on placement. And, okay, so how are you going to do this? And let's figure this out together. As well as we have returning vets that have seen my story and are inspired by that and decide that, you know, they'll go that same route. And nothing makes me happier than when I see these young men returning from Afghanistan and Iraq, and then they're in our kitchens, and they're the best. They're the leaders.
Because
there's a perspective. And there's a perspective
that
you...
So what did the military give you that you carry into the kitchen?
What the Marines gave me was a sense of an understanding of mission, of what the mission is, and doing whatever you need to do to complete the mission. And so if the mission in this case as a cook is to set your station and be ready to serve the guest and to serve them flawlessly, then understanding that mission allows you to prioritize everything in your day within the scope of what your station happens to be. And you can apply that as a chef today. My mission is really to inspire my chefs, to inspire their cooks, to inspire the customer and the guests each and every night in our restaurants. And it's a philosophy of prioritizing and not getting too distracted by all the bells and whistles, and really simplifying your approach to what would otherwise be, you know, rather kind of nitpicky and arduous
process.
So
the organizational skills and the strategic skills that you learn in the military really do apply in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
And that's why they're so good.
And I think they apply to every facet of life. Mm-hmm. But in the kitchen, I think that it's an environment that we're comfortable with because of the structure that's there.
Right.
And so my father was a fighter pilot, and I thought that was the route I wanted to go, you know, mm-hmm. just to prove I could be as good as dad. And then, to be honest, I loved the Marine Corps, had a great time, have friendships that will last forever through that experience. But I knew this isn't what I'm called to do forever. You know, let me do my time, let me get out, and let me make a difference.
So I can
do that through food.
So as soon as you got out, what did you do? Go for a good meal.
As soon as I got out, I wanted to come home so bad, just to...
Where were you?
I flew into Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and...
Where were you?
I was at Culinary Institute of America. I was going to school. I'd already been active duty, then switched to the reserves so that I could go to school. And I was halfway through school when I got pulled out for a year and a half to go to the first Gulf War. And at that time, I thought, oh, heck, you know, I've worked so hard to get here. Now I'm here. And now I'm going to die somewhere in a desert, never really accomplishing anything. And I really thought that. I thought, well, okay, this is how it's got to be. Then I'll just give it my best shot. And so lo and behold, I make it back. I'm fine. And I came back with so much determination that I wanted to see this through. I knew I had something to offer the world other than to die in a alone in the desert. And so that experience really gave me perspective. And that's the perspective that a lot of our young cooks coming from the military today have, that they've seen other parts of this world that they don't want to go back to. And they realize, you know, what's really important here. And so, but the first thing that I did was I had to get back home. And during this time, this is before email and all that good stuff, there's no texting. I had a pen pal during the conflict, which happened to be my best friend's sister. And she and I, who grew up together, but never, you know, we would never think about it, we ended up falling in love. And I, 3 months later, I'm proposing marriage, and she says yes.
Oh,
and so anyway,
story.
She'll probably have a different story. It's probably not so wonderful, you know, marrying a chef. But it was really interesting that, you know, I knew at that moment I had to get back. I had to go home. The first thing that I had when I got back was a fried soft-shell crab po' boy with, like, doused in hot sauce with shredded lettuce and slathered in blue plate mayonnaise. Like, I knew what I wanted. That was that. And I ate, and I just bathed and gumbos and etouffees and all these things that I thought were slightly passé were the very things that I was craving. So I come back to school, finish school, but I still knew that even though I wanted to be home, I still needed to leave again. I needed to build that foundation. And so applied everywhere to had a job offer from Le Gavre Rouge in London, and then had a job offer from in France. I wanted to work for the for Trois Gros in France, or to go and work in for the Roux Brothers in London. And I couldn't get papers to work in either one of those places.
Right.
And I didn't come from money, and so I was going to have to pay my own way. And so there was really no way of doing that. So I ended up going, through family connections and friends that knew of this great place in the mountains of the Black Forest on the France, Switzerland, and Germany border. Mm-hmm. And I worked at this two-star Michelin restaurant called the Romantic Hotel Spielweg, which has been in business
did
since.
Did you have white asparagus?
Oh, we had
white asparagus.
Best, like, spargelzeit. Yeah, the asparagus season takes on, like, you know, almost a spiritual proportions there. And I had this incredible food, which, mostly affected by was this understanding of localism and this balance that existed there and that's existed there for centuries of eating from the season, what was of the of the area, and cooking in a way that was culturally significant. And again, it's making me think of, wow, I had this back home. It's just a little different. But and that idea of localism was something that was a seed that was planted there. And yet, you know, we had on the West Coast, Alice Waters was just really starting, you know, I think her critical acclaim was really on the rise at that point. And we also had, Larry Forgione on the East Coast that, you know, was really doing this. Right. And so these things were percolating on both coasts. I go and I discover this up through this apprenticeship. And so I'm working there for about a year and a half. And then I came back and started working in New Orleans again. Started working for a chef out in the country. He had a little Frenchman by the name of Constantine Caragiorgio, a Greek name, French guy from Marseille. and which only if you're familiar with the area of the Bouches du Rhône and, you know, the cultural makeup of that area, could you understand the Greek thing, the Greek connection. But Marseille is just, you know, this entire region is just populated by people. Maybe, you know, they're a little Italian, they're a little Spanish, they're a little Greek, and yet they're all 100% French. And so he owned this little restaurant.
Marseille, Louisiana. Right.
No, this is Marseille, France. And he settled. He came from France, settled in Louisiana.
Oh,
and so I started
Spanish, Greek.
And so he,
his
background was that of Marseille. Mm. And then, so he comes and he opens this beautiful little restaurant, really, two bayous over from like where I grew up. So like out in the sticks, and beautiful little place. But he decides that, you know, I have this experience in Germany and it's great and it's very classical, but I need to learn how to cook like the French grandmother, so to speak. And so each summer he has me spend my summers and I'm working for friends of his in France, and I'm cooking with his brother, and we're raking in mussels in Port Saint Louis, and then we're, and he sends me on this, you know, truly like a culinary
field trip.
Field trip where I'm
experiencing
right, these different things that he wants me to see. Mm-hmm. Well, and that led to. And I could do this because I'd get paid every year to go to the Chateau de Moncaux, and it's in Bagnols sur Cèze, France. And I would spend the summer there cooking, and I would also have time to travel around. So my wife and I would pack up and take our little son, Brendan. I think the first time he went, he was 10 days old.
Oh, my gosh.
And we're off to France for the summer.
Your wife does have her own story.
Oh, she's got a story. And so make a long story short, just through those subsequent years of doing that, I really developed a love and passion for that, you know, for the food of Provence, which is so similar to the food of Louisiana.
Really?
And yeah, everything wow. from the rice culture that
That's
exists
true,
there
yeah.
to the identity, you know, the game, the seafood, all found aren't, you know, it's really quite similar. Outside of course, gumbo does not exist anywhere in Provence, but the idea of you know, cooking with what you have, right. the idea of localism, the idea of cooking things with, you know, that are significant to a culture, again, that really played a role in my development of who am I as a cook, and who will I be one day as a chef. And so years later, you know, I'm back, I have my own restaurants. I'm opening Restaurant August, and I'm driven at that point by really just pride. I'm driven to be the best and have my name, you know, associated with awards. And I wanted to create food that nobody could pronounce and very few people could, you know, really identify, because, you know, it was architectural and it had to be just. I was cooking just so out of pride that I really lost touch with, you know, why is it that I became a cook to begin with? And it really, and the restaurant took off, and that was great, but there was still something missing. And then Hurricane Katrina came, which just changed everything.
Okay, we're going to take a break here, because now we're going to go to post-Katrina when we come back. Listening to Chef Story, I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I'm interviewing John Besh from New Orleans with his 9 restaurants, probably one of the most lauded restaurants in the country is Restaurant August. And we're just talking about how he started that, and we're getting into the big New Orleans story of Katrina. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I speak about having left New Orleans from time to time and always feeling this draw back, and on my journey discovering things about my own culture that I had always taken for granted or hadn't really discovered on my own. And this was the first time that the city was really taken from me. And I see this whole thing unraveling. See the misery that existed. And I thought to myself, just like everybody does when you see a tragedy like this, what can I do? Why am I here? My life has to be more than just about a fancy award or James Beard Award or to have this plaque hanging on the wall.
And by that time, you had won those.
And I had a lot of critical acclaim, and I was the chef in New Orleans and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And not that I was unhappy, but I was unhappy. Because that's not what brings... That alone does not do it. I think a human spirit needs...
When you said you were unhappy, were you unhappy when Katrina hit or before? Or were you unfulfilled?
I think I was
unfulfilled.
Unfulfilled would be a better way of putting it. Because I just felt like I have a lot more to offer than what I'm actually doing. Like, just fancy food alone isn't enough. And so it took Katrina, it took just 2 days after the storm of... figuring out what we're going to do and how we're going to, how are we going to make a difference? How am I? And what, I was given these gifts for a reason. And how am I going to use these, this talent that I have? And I'm thinking, I'm only a cook. Like, when it comes down to it, I can solve very few problems in this world. I cook for a living. And it hit me that there's hungry people out there. And I have resources. And I have friends with resources, and I can marshal resources that most people couldn't hope to secure. And so we started this effort. It was myself, everybody else we sent away. I made sure my family left early, leave. And I was alone with one of my best friends now, and one of my, a partner of mine who's now my chef at Dominica, Alan Shaya, who originally from Tel Aviv had he had nowhere to go. And so it's me and Alan living in my beaten up Land Rover Defender and with his two cats. And so
and
he and I kind of figured out
what happened.
My house was actually okay. We were in the process of, we had already been sunk by one hurricane, and we were building another house at the time that had some trees through it, but it wasn't completely flooded.
But why were you living in the, you couldn't live in the house, that's why you're living in the car?
And so, well, I couldn't get to the house, and so it's kind of stuck in between New Orleans and my home.
I see.
And where do we, and so basically for the first 2 days we're out, just kind of like it literally in the car, out of gas, like wondering what the heck are we going to do, how are we going to do it. And so, but it's interesting that hitting that low and seeing and understanding that, like, New Orleans is gone, it is done, and people are, there's so many people out there that need help. What am I going to do? And that lit a fire. We started, Alan was there by my side, and we literally started cooking red beans and rice in my front yard on what we call crawfish pots, these big, cauldrons over propane, these big pots over these little propane tanks. And we started this process of just cooking red beans and rice 24 hours a day, and we would cook the red beans, cook the rice, pour them both together in these big igloo ice chests, put them into boats, take the boats out and feed people in these flat bottom boats. And you could actually take the boat, and there was a roundabout way of getting into, like, the really poorly, hard-hit areas of New Orleans, where you're just on the interstate, and the exit ramps would serve as boat ramps. And you could, the exit ramps would just really kind of let you down. Just the streets were flooded, so you just launch your boat right there and go out. And so we started these feeding missions. The first guy that I fed, and I've told the story a number of times, but it still hits me as being that was really the point that I realized I was doing something good. Argues with me about how bad my red beans are and how his mother's red beans are better. And where's the salt pork? Because his mom always used the salt pork. And then, did I have any hot sauce? And I'm like, dude, are you serious? Like, I'm in the same situation as you.
Yeah.
Like, we've got nothing, but you know, you're eating your vegetarian red beans today, and you're going to be happy with it. And I knew at that point, like, yeah, this is a really cool city. Like, we could have this conversation about whose red beans are better at a time of utter disaster.
Right.
And so it's really interesting that this, what started as a good deed, and you know, we fed people until there were no more people to feed. Then to feed, rather, I'm sorry. And then we have National Guard troops coming in from all around the country, but they have no food. Nobody's really thought this one through. And so they're needing food. And so we then created a couple of different little,
sorry,
like...
Are you working out of your home?
I started out of the home, and then we moved to the restaurant where we had a secure place there. And then we set up several different feeding points and cooking points. One of them being, I'll never forget, a Walmart parking lot. In the St. Thomas neighborhood of New Orleans, which was just in chaos. You know, we had police were just trying to manage what was taking place. Buildings were on fire. The city is absolutely drowning.
Where are you getting the red beans?
And so we're pulling from people in southwest Louisiana, started shuttling red beans over.
Right.
Former Marine friends of mine, one of them being a rice farmer in Arkansas, started sending over a ton of rice. And just all these different people, just again pulling the resources that we had, would find a way. Everything was lawless, and so you just broke the law. You just invented your own laws. And this kind of this tenacity, I think, that I really borrowed from the Marines, and understanding that in combat everything's chaos, and that's where mission and having a focus and what doing whatever you have to do to achieve that mission really came in handy here, because this was like, okay, I know what to do here. I'm not waiting for permission. We're just going to act, and we're going to act with a good heart, and everything's going to be okay. And this went on for weeks, and then the oil companies needed to get the their refineries up and running, and so we were basically the only people there at the time, and so we were able to land some contracts by feeding the oil companies, which we are happy to charge.
Yes. No, I was going to say the economic impact on the city was as devastating as the physical impact.
Oh, good gosh!
And it is more long lasting, in fact.
Yeah, and everything was just completely shut down, and so that's when it hit me that I'm not just the chef, and I'm not just feeding people who are hungry. Now I need to be the employer. Like, to be an employer, there's a responsibility there that people need jobs.
Yes.
And that if I can arrange these contracts, I can give people jobs. So we started, but what do? We have no people. It was just myself. And at that point, only have one business partner at this point. He used to be the maitre d', and I was the cook, and now he's my he's acting sous chef / CFO, and we have nobody. So we start this thing. This is the first time. Cell phones don't work, but what we learned how to do is text. You could text, but you couldn't talk. And so we started sending text out of, if you can make it back, whenever you can make it back, we will house you, we will feed you, and we will pay you for all the lost time. but you're only getting paid for all that lost time if you come back. And so people started coming in. People needed jobs. They needed money.
Yeah.
Because they were going to their ATMs and there was nothing.
Right.
And they were...
And a lot of people live paycheck to paycheck.
So most people do.
Yeah. And so, you know, you don't work, you don't eat.
And so that's when it hit me that I have another responsibility, and that is to truly be a good and just employer.
Yeah.
And to offer something that we all need. And we started doing that, and then we started sharing the profits that we were making. So all of a sudden, one of my cooks that came, the first cook that came back, or one of them, you know, they were getting bonuses of $10,000 and $15,000 whenever we would kind of have a little extra to share. And one of, you know, and eventually when we divided it all, then they were seeing money like they've never seen before. And it wasn't that they were working for me for the money, but it was the idea of, I didn't think we were going to last. I thought I would definitely be bankrupt. I just paid off my last partner, took out a huge loan to buy the restaurant just before the storm. And so I thought, I'm a goner. But we're going to go down in style. We're going to go down taking care of everybody that is here bailing us out. And lo and behold, we ended up making it. And so we're doing these mass catering contracts. And then we're also focused on, at the same time, reopening August. And I wanted August to, you know, we're not going to use paper plates. We're not, you know, this is a place that I want people to come and escape what's happening in their lives. And it really became a cornerstone within the community of a place, an act of defiance was to go out and have a nice meal when you came back to discover your house totally consumed by floodwaters. And so people, as they would come back in, we would see them, and everybody would come into August. I didn't even have a bartender. The drinks are there, write down whatever. And so there was an honor system. So then prominent people within the community would just come and say, you know what, I'm going to tend bar for you on Friday. And another person would say, I'll be your bartender on Saturday. We can't continue this. Other, you know, beautiful ladies that felt like, you know, this connection with August all of a sudden would say, you know what, I want to be your hostess tonight. And that the people just come in. And so then it started taking on this really communal, just a almost spiritual.
Were you feeling fulfilled?
I was then starting to feel very vulnerable, but I felt like there is a purpose to what it is that I do. And it's bigger than me. And I think that discovering just how important food is, and that it's that common thread that keeps us all, that links us together. And it's also that which we celebrate everything. If you think of even every major religion has this altar, which is a table that people come, you know, this is
it's true.
Like the food is such a powerful tool. And it can be used for it can be used for good. And I found that out. And that's what really has been driving me ever since, is trying to find the good in it. And how can we make a difference through food?
We don't have a lot of time. Actually, we're going to go over today. Because you have to tell about your efforts now, what you're doing, and how you're transforming lives.
Well, I thought hitting this all-time low after Hurricane Katrina, and then that really made me think about the vulnerability of this culture. And this culture is bigger than just a chef. And when I say culture, I talk about growing up in a food culture, in a significant culture, shaped who it is that I am and how I cook and how I even think about food. And when I see, you know, I remember just seeing the talking heads, the political pundits on TV, both sides of the aisle, curious or discussing whether or not New Orleans should be reinvested in or rebuilt. And I look at it and think, like, these were federal levies that failed us. These people of New Orleans. You know, we didn't ask for this. We didn't bring it upon ourselves. And this is a great place with really good people and this incredible culture. How can you say You know, how could one even ponder
that you're going to abandon it?
Right, that you might abandon the one, probably I would dare to say the most American of all cultures comes from there, because this is a place that truly absorbed people from all over in creating its indigenous, you know, the Creole culture.
Harmony,
that we think of.
A new forged identity.
This is where our music came from.
Right.
Made its ways through the highways and byways and waterways throughout the arteries of this country that gave us the blues, that gave us jazz, that gave us rock and roll, that gave us Motown.
Yeah.
This is the food that, whether any inner city calls it soul food, but it's just food to us. And so how, you know, like, this is a really significant place. The only way that we're going to get back on our feet is if we all work together. And that's where this idea of localism really came into play. How am I going to protect our culture? Well, first I need to make sure that we're protecting, you know, what agriculture is left. And that we protect our fisheries. And we talk about it, and we raise money and awareness for rebuilding the wetlands that we're losing at an astronomical rate. Not due to ourselves, but again, the federal government has, you know, the Corps of Engineers, which really fouled up a lot of, you know, that's really fouled up our wetlands, which will pose a significant threat to our fisheries if we don't pay attention to these things. So multi-pronged, like, we have so many problems. What am I going to do? And that's when, you know, we came up with various things like we came up with the John Besh Foundation, which is funding microloan programs for farmers. And I would like to open that up to farmers, fishers, crabbers, you name it, protecting our foodways again. People that can't, through conventional means, acquire the capital that they need to continue or to expand their farming or fishing operations, have a place that they can come to for that. And not only that, but we've partnered with Tulane University's Master of Business School to give these farmers and fishers the business acumen that they need to achieve their financial goals and make sure that those loans are paid back so that they can be doled out to others. Then we looked at the human side of this, and it was interesting that I'm walking through the kitchen one day and I'm looking around why do all our cooks look like me? Where are the black cooks? Because this is a historically African-American community. Why aren't black people applying at my restaurants? And it really came down to a lot of people within that community had no idea of the possibilities of the career path, the hope of you know, a chef these days can do much better than
just being a cook in a fast food restaurant.
Yeah, that it doesn't have to end with just becoming, you know, this with an entry level job. A living paycheck to paycheck, that you can prosper, but to do that you need training, and you need people that that value your human dignity and that value your humanity. Period. And so that's when I partnered with one of your graduates, Jessica Bride Barrett, who truly felt the same way. We met in an airport, crossing paths, and she said, "What if?" And I said, "What if?" And then we put our heads together and created a scholarship called Chef's Move, where I had worked with a number of outreach programs and still do in New Orleans and require that all of our chefs work with these outreach programs. So it's just not me, but it's all of us together trying to lend a hand to the people within the community that need help and that need a helping hand and need a little bit of mentorship. And through these outreach programs like Cafe Reconcile, Cafe Hope, Liberty's Kitchen for that matter, they're programs that offer training just on a very rudimentary level and life skills classes, just trying to get people in back to work, period. Those are great, but what happens with a person with the tenacity and the smarts and with the drive that aspires more out of life than just that entry-level position? They get kind of, you know, they're lost. Culinary schools are so darn expensive now, and I know for good reason, but they are. And so you're paying exclusive college tuition prices to go into a field that essentially, at best, is going to pay you about $10 an hour when you graduate. And so it's hard. That's a hard nut for a lot of people to swallow. And so I started thinking about this, and what we would have to do is create this scholarship for those people that were kind of that had much more potential. And so we started the process here with the ICC in hopes of exposing people to a bigger world, to broadening the horizons, taking them from the neighborhood New Orleans, bringing them to Manhattan.
I know, it's wonderful.
And then the mentorship that takes place, and then have people like Marcus Samuelson reaching out to offer help, and having people like Aaron Sanchez offering help to young minorities that need to see that there are other people in the field that are doing great things. Mm-hmm. And it's just not about making money, of course, but just...
Tell our listeners how they can contribute.
Well, we would love it if you would go to, if you would, you can look us up online at chefjohnbesch.com, or you can go just direct to Chef's Move. Look us up. We're there. We'll make it more than easy for you to donate. And just know that, you know, all of us are called, I think, to make a change in our own neighborhoods. And this is just an example of what we're doing that's really, I think, changing lives for the better.
Oh, it's been great to have you here today. I wish we could go on and on.
I know. As you can see, I'm kind of passionate about this subject.
I can see. So can I tell you one bad joke before we leave?
Uh-oh.
Okay. How can you tell when you're in a Cajun zoo? You have the recipe by the Latin name.
That's bad.
That's bad. Well, thanks.
So
thanks
true.
Again. And I want to thank John Besch for being here today. And shout out to our producers. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.